Today, I'll talk with the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Susan Laurie Parks. She's taken George and Ira Gershwin's opera Porgy and Bess and rewritten it, trying to turn it into a hit for Broadway.
Right away, it was very clear that these people who were singing songs of love and passion deserve a story that is equal to it.
And later this hour, you know all those best-selling books of heartfelt revelation by celebrities and politicians? You don't really think they write them, do you?
On the non-fiction bestseller list, 12 out of the 15 books listed probably have been ghostwritten.
We're letting the ghostwriters go public.
If I get thanked for my good cheer one more time, I'm going to go postal.
I'm Kurt Anderson. That plus Mitt Romney, American Dad. Head this hour in Studio 360. Stay with us.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today on the show, we'll check in on a team of experts we've hired to take on our next big redesign. Teachers. It's time to ditch the one-room schoolhouse with a bell motif and rebrand educators for the 21st century.
Taking into consideration how much more sophisticated students are today.
Doctors have MD in the end of their name. Maybe we could get Jenna Shapiro, E, in the end. Educator.
But to start the show...
Thank you, New Hampshire. Tonight we made history.
As Mitt Romney wraps up his audition to be the Republican nominee, he continues to fight for control of his image.
Mitt looks like the guy your mother points to and says, "Why can't you be more like him?" He looks like a former Tarzan, Mitt.
I mean, you can't get more presidential looking than Mitt Romney.
Is that guy a Pixar character? Like, is that even... He looks like an alien pod had created him to be a president. Like, somehow it found a handsome guy.
With all of the televised debates and the campaign commercials, pop culture becomes a kind of irresistible template to try to get a handle on candidates like Mitt Romney. And here to help me figure out where else we've seen this movie before is David Edelstein, the movie critic for New York Magazine. David, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you very much, Kurt.
So why do you think so much of the commentary about this one guy, Mitt Romney, treats him as a character?
Well, because if you were a casting director and you submitted Mitt Romney, you would be laughed out of the office. They would all say it's too on the nose. He looks too much like he's supposed to look. You know, back in the 60s, remember when we threw out all the glamorous leading men and we fell on people like Dustin Hoffman? There's still part of us that looks at somebody like Mitt Romney and just says he's not real. Nowadays, if you have a Brad Pitt, if you have somebody who's stunningly handsome, in order to be taken seriously,
it's hard.
They have to ugly themselves up first.
Right.
They have to play a junkie, a scratchy junkie, and Mitt is never going to do that.
Well, and it's interesting. When, as you say, movie stars became less pretty in the 60s and 70s, it was also the time when there was this, when the certain kind of Romney-esque American president was cast over and over and over again, this kind of waspy, square-jawed, gray temple guy, of which he is the amazingly perfect Hollywood exemplar of another age.
Except he is a Mormon. And now Mormons are now suddenly the squeaky clean, you know, the role that wasps used to fill before we chucked out the patriarchy as we did. You know, it's only the Mormon culture that has, I think, clung to that archetype in the same way.
That's interesting. So in the way that he seems like a 50s person. Mm-hmm. That's partly, we think, maybe, arguably, due to the Mormonism. Peggy Noonan in the Wall Street Journal recently wrote that Romney is, quote, a little like the father in one of those 1950s or 60s sitcoms. And, well, let's listen to Ward Cleaver to remind us and our listeners what he was like.
You know, Dad, it's funny.
What's funny?
Well, whenever we cook inside, Mom always does the cooking. But whenever we cook outside, you always do it. How come?
Well, it's sort of traditional, I guess. You know, they say a woman's place is in the home, and I suppose as long as she's in the home, she might as well be in the kitchen.
Oh. Well, that explains about Mom, but how come you always do the outside cooking?
Well, I'll tell you, son. Women do all right when they have all the modern conveniences, but us men are better at this rugged type of outdoor cooking. Sort of a throwback to caveman days. Hand me those asbestos gloves, would you, Molly? Well, there's no sense in us cavemen burning our hands.
No, I loved Ward Cleaver, not as much as the My Three Sons Fred McMurray character, but Ward Cleaver was a good guy. Doesn't being Ward Cleaver in this crazy 21st century moment help you as a candidate?
But do you remember what happened in the 80s, and with the advent of David Letterman, we started to watch those shows as camp. But you look at Ronald Reagan. A lot of us came up with the Father Knows Best, My Three Sons comparisons when Ronald Reagan
Absolutely.
Became president. But Ronald Reagan, although he was not a method actor in Hollywood, he was rather wooden, was an unbelievably great method actor when it came to playing president. And he also had core values. And you know that, you know, even if you didn't believe a word that was coming out of his mouth, you knew that he believed, you knew he
was selling
it. At that
moment, he believed
it. At that moment, he believed
it. The same way Bill Clinton could tell various fibs and cut corners. But he believed it at that second.
Bill Clinton's mind worked so fast that he could project more sincerity than the greatest Hollywood actors, even when you knew he was feeding you a line.
The other kind of character, movie character, that Mitt Romney reminds me of is the sort of nice guy, second lead character in a Kate Hepburn movie that she's supposed to like and she's supposed
right.
to marry, but really wants to go with Cary Grant.
You're thinking of Ralph Bellamy. Very squared off shoulders, very kind of studiously bland, very earnest. You know, you're impressed by him, but your erotic fantasies don't go there.
Which describes, apparently, the Republican Party's feelings about Mitt Romney. Yeah, we're going to marry him, but we want to have these exciting guys for a while first.
You can't marry that guy.
Why not?
Well, I don't know. I followed before it at first, but you just don't seem to match up.
Then the fault's with me.
Well, maybe so, but all the same, now you can't do it.
No.
He's also referred to, and I think I have more than once referred to him as the robo candidate, which is an easy, cheap shot shorthand. There is this, bless him, relentless upbeatness. He never gets angry. He never scowls. He never goes for the red meat the way so many other candidates do.
That's what's so remarkable about it. All of the classic Hollywood political movies are all about someone being relentlessly programmed by handlers, moving away from his or her core values.
Henry Fonda.
Right.
Yes.
In The Best Man. And then at the end, rejecting them and giving some sort of big speech in which he throws away the prepared text and speaks from the heart for the first time and wins the adoration.
Well, we're not at the end yet here. He could do it.
It's true, although I haven't seen much evidence of spontaneity in the persona he's projected so far.
Now, if, as we presume, he is the Republican nominee and he's running for president against Barack Obama, it's not two characters that you'd start with if you were trying to make a movie or a TV show. They're both these tall, skinny, elitist Harvard grads, right? I mean, they're similar.
Yeah, in fact, it's a little weird, you know, with Obama's sort of comparisons to Will Smith. You'd really look at Romney and Obama together, and you'd want to say, wait a minute, shouldn't they be two detectives? Shouldn't they go out and solve murders together? Why are they debating each other? I mean, there's just something about them that is just classically Hollywood.
David Edelstein, thank you very much.
Thank you, Kurt.
David Edelstein is the movie critic for New York Magazine. So, what movie or TV character do you think of when you think of Mitt Romney? Who did we overlook? Tell us at studio360.org.
you gonna do? Bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? Bad boys, what you
One thing Mitt Romney is particularly proud of is that he actually wrote his own book, No Apologies, The Case for American Greatness. Maybe that shouldn't be surprising, but the nonfiction bestseller list is chock full of books by politicians and other celebrities that were actually written for them by ghostwriters. Ghostwriting is part of the publishing business that is, for obvious reasons, kept out of sight. But it is a booming trade. So we sent Studio 360's Eric Molinsky out on a friendly ghost-busting mission.
Madeline Morrell is going to let you in on a secret.
On the nonfiction bestseller list, 12 out of the 15 books listed probably have been ghostwritten.
She should know. Morrell is a literary agent who only represents ghostwriters. Her clients have written books for authors like Mike Huckabee and Sarah Ferguson. Yes, author is the technical term for the celebrity whose name is on the cover.
You know, I'm really like a publishing matchmaker.
She sets up a date between the author and the ghostwriter that she thinks will fit their needs best.
But it doesn't always work. Sometimes the ghostwriter will decide they can't stand working with the author because a lot of authors are very exacting. You know, they don't quite understand that a ghostwriter is more than a glorified amanuensis.
I had to look that up, too. It's an old word for a stenographer. Gene Stone has been ghostwriting for 20 years. For contractual reasons, he can't reveal the names of many of the authors that he worked with, but they include a movie star, a politician, a celebrity chef, and a big CEO. Writing somebody else's autobiography can be a very intimate experience.
You're a therapist, you're a brother, you're a father, you're a priest, you're a confessor.
Yeah, then you have to turn yourself into Meryl Streep. You have to then become them at the end of the day.
But I'm doing a really good job. When the book is done, it comes out, that person's friends say, hey, what did you need a ghostwriter for? I mean, it's just you.
That's why there's a lot of pressure to keep the ghostwriter invisible. Madeline Morrell likes to pretend that her clients are dying to see their names on the cover. But for a higher price, they'll stay anonymous.
It's a nice negotiating point, you know. All right, my client won't put their name on the cover if... It doesn't always work, because I think a lot of people are quite well aware of the fact that writers don't actually care that much. You know, I'm sure it's the writer's mother who cares more than the writer in many cases.
Right, so long as the ghostwriter's name is on the check. Here's another secret. If you want to know who really wrote the book, read the acknowledgments.
The more menial a task somebody is thanked for in a book, the greater chance it is that they actually wrote the entire book.
Barbara Feinman Todd always found the acknowledgments kind of demeaning.
If I get thanked for my good cheer one more time, I'm going to go postal. I am not full of good cheer, and I should not be thanked for it.
She also wasn't thanked for ghostwriting Hillary Clinton's 1996 bestseller, It Takes a Village. Republicans used that oversight against Clinton, and the former first lady doubled down on her claim that she wrote the whole book. Barbara Feinman Todd, the ghostwriter, became a political football. But by that point, she was already disillusioned.
You know, one of the top three goals is not telling the truth. And I think that's a problem when you're selling a book and it goes in the nonfiction section in the bookstore.
So she quit. Now she teaches journalism at Georgetown.
As a journalist, I'm trained to use everything that's good. As a ghostwriter, you get the access that journalists can only dream of, but you don't have the control over the story.
But her students might have to resort to ghostwriting to pay the bills. The magazine and newspaper industries are shrinking, and blogs don't pay anything, or much. When Gene Stone started ghostwriting, he'd be embarrassed to tell journalists what he did for a living.
And whereas they once looked at me and said, oh, you're a ghostwriter, well, I have a real job. Now they're calling me up and going, how do I get into this ghostwriting thing?
Now, I talked with ghostwriters on the East Coast and the West Coast, and I noticed that the L.A. ghosts don't have that same sense of embarrassment. David Renson wrote Chris Rock's book, Rock This, in Tim Allen's bestseller, Don't Stand Too Close to a Naked Man.
We came up with the title at lunch. He was telling me about being in prison, and I said, well, you don't want to stand too close to a naked man then. And he said, that's the title. Or maybe it was the other way around. I'll give him the credit.
Ranson prefers to be called a collaborator or co-author. He hates the word ghostwriter.
I don't think that writing with somebody is necessarily milquetoast. It can be. And I've seen plenty of books out there that are either whitewashes or trash talk. And I'm not interested in that. I really want the human being to come through.
Which is what we want from these books, to feel closer. Publishers seek out celebrities because they come with their own fan base, thousands of Twitter followers, their own cable shows. Again, here's Gene Stone.
It used to be that 20 years ago, they'd say, well, this guy's very telegenic. I like what he's saying. We can get him on Oprah. Now, the person comes in and, what's your platform? How can you launch this book? What can you do to make this book happen?
That's why it makes sense for someone with a huge following like Sarah Palin to write a book, or at least promote a book that she quote-unquote wrote. Her book, Going Rogue, sold 3 million copies. David Ranson sees nothing wrong with that.
People are going to buy it because it's got Sarah Palin's name and ideas in it, okay? And they don't make the decision based on, oh, she wrote it or she didn't write it. As long as she helped write it, cooperated in writing it, took part in it, it's authentic.
Well, maybe for him. But Gene Stone worries that ghostwriting is perpetuating a myth that anyone can write a book, that writing isn't a specialized craft requiring a well-paid professional. This really hit home when he was watching a talk show once, and one of the celebrities he worked with said to the host,
oh, yeah, I wrote the book in the shower. I wrote the book before breakfast. It was, people talk about how difficult it is to write a book, but it's actually very easy. And I thought, well, that's not true. You didn't do anything. But, that's our culture.
Former ghostwriter Barbara Fineman Todd.
I cannot tell you how many times I've been contacted by people who say, everybody tells me I should write a book, that my story is amazing. And a lot of people think they should write a book. It's therapy. And I say to you, find a good therapist. Do not find a good ghostwriter.
For Studio 360, I'm Eric Molinsky.
As a little kid, I was impressed that John F. Kennedy had written a terrific history book that won the Pulitzer Prize. And then, later, had my teenage cynicism stoked when I found out that Profiles in Courage was written by one of his aides. What is the best celebrity book you've read? And do you care if the quote-unquote author was actually the author? Let us know at studio360.org. Coming up, Susan Lurie Parks has rewritten one of the great American classics, Porgy and Bess. But she says, don't freak out.
What's unfortunate about a lot of people, they hear Susan Lurie Parks is working on it, or they hear a black woman is working on it. She'll find it racist, and then she'll have to fix all these political...
Right.
I look at it as, yes, as a black woman, but also as a writer.
I'll talk with Susan Lurie Parks about improving on the Gershwins. That's next up in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. Fish are jumping, and the cotton is high.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Susan Lurie Parks remembers her introduction to Porgy and Bess, the groundbreaking opera about poor black people in South Carolina. She was in second grade, it was 1970, and she caught the Porgy and Bess movie on television.
I vaguely remember like one of those scenes from childhood. It was like the late, 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 late show. And 5 minutes of it, and I just was like, oh, I don't think so. Fish are jumping. it looked like one of those movies where they didn't quite get to know us like I knew us. It had a certain, things that make your head pull back, and it smells funny, even through the TV.
Yeah, so, and you've not seen a stage performance.
No. But I knew all the songs. That's the thing.
Right.
I knew all the songs. I mean,
one does.
We used to sing them around the house. Me and my mom used to sing Summertime around the house. Ella Fitzgerald was the one me and my mom and dad listened to.
Oh, your daddy's rich and your mom.
Flash forward a few decades, and Susan Laurie Parks is a Pulitzer Prize-winning MacArthur Genius playwright. The estates of George and Ira Gershwin come calling. They want a new version of Porgy and Bess, the 75-year-old opera, that can work on Broadway in 2012. So Parks has turned some of the lyrics into dialogue, fleshed out the characters, put in new backstories, but it remains the tale of a crippled man, Porgy, who falls in love with the town tramp, Bess, played by Audra McDonald.
So hush, little baby, don't you cry.
Even before the show opened, some traditionalists went berserk. Stephen Sondheim wrote a long, angry letter to the New York Times. One of the things that most bothered him was that the new version from Susan Laurie Parks is called The Gershwin's Porgy and Bess.
It's as if the Gershwin estate has a brownstone. They invited me to do some work on their brownstone. It's their brownstone.
And they want to call it The Gershwin's.
It's their brownstone. Yeah. They can call it, whatever they want. I mean, it is their property.
Yeah.
They invited us to work on it. And end of conversation. I mean, really?
Yeah. So what did you think, you and your director think, okay, what is missing here to translate it to an audience in 2012 in the Broadway stage?
Right.
What was your first sense of, here's what we have to do?
My first sense, right away, it was very clear that these people who were singing these songs of love and passion and, triumph and failure and all these incredibly powerful songs, that they deserve a story that is equal to it. And the book had, which is brilliantly written. I mean, first of all, Du Bois and Dorothy Hayward wrote the play.
And
based
a novel
on,
before
based
that.
On, yes, based on Mr. Hayward's novel. Right. So Mr. Hayward initially wrote the novel called Porgy. He and his wife adapted it into a play, and then they went on to write the libretto. Brilliantly, beautifully, very beautifully written. Dramaturgically, there are some holes that have nothing to do with any of the politically correct buttons that people think,
that it was white people portraying black people in this certain way.
I find it just just dramaturgically, there's some holes in it.
Like what?
Well, for example, when they sing that beautiful song, Bess, You Is My Woman Now, that beautiful love duet. And then moments later, Bess goes to the picnic. And, I don't know. But if I were to sing, a love song to my sweetheart, and then 2 minutes later he's going to a picnic, I would need a reason why I'm not going with him. And so we just added a bridge to that. And it's a bridge not just to fill in a gap, but to provide Porgy and Bess, and the whole community actually, with a really strong story arc. So Porgy has a reason why he stays behind.
Which is to say he's getting a brace.
Yes, he says, I'm staying behind and getting a new brace and a cane. So while she's off on Kittawa.
I bought that.
Well, yeah, it's just a little bridge, that it strengthens his quest to secure her love. So all the characters now, all the main characters, have a really strong story arc.
I want to play a clip. This is David Alan Greer playing
Yay.
Sportin' Life, the tempting devil of the piece.
Woo! Look at that sport life! Dressed to the nines for Saturday night!
Looking good ain't no crime.
No, but the way you play craps sure is.
Oh, nobody knows when the Lord is gonna call. Rolling bones, roll, roll. It may be in the summertime, it may be in the fall. Rolling bones, roll.
Sportin' Life has always been one of the both comic relief and more entertaining
yes.
characters in this show. Did you feel like you had to do much work with his character and his story?
There are questions that I had and others had about Sportin' Life from the very beginning. Is he from that community or not? Is he, you know, so what's his relationship to those folks? And then just sort of enjoying the sort of how real Sportin' Life is and how he speaks to, you know, the sort of pimp culture of today,
mm-hmm.
you know. I mean, it's still set in the 1930s, but the pimp culture of today and just how much, just saying it's okay for him to be kind of a snaky guy, you know. He's a snake. He's a pimp. He's a drug dealer, after all. He's not a simply, you know, song and dance kind
right.
of guy. He's an unsavory character.
And did you
who is incredibly charming,
yes.
just like a pimp,
a yeah. successful pimp,
right? Exactly.
And did you emphasize the things like the happy dust, the drugs, and his pimpiness and blinginess to make it more resonant? And
I don't think so. I just sort of made, you know, it's okay for Sportin' Life to be an unsavory character,
right? Rather than just the fun guy.
The fun guy, yeah. He's the guy everyone wants to be around, but not because he's always a barrel of laughs, you know.
Now, George and Ira Gershwin, white people,
yes.
the authors of the novel and book,
yes.
white people.
Yes.
And partly, I suppose, as a result of that, from its first production through the 60s and 70s
right.
and beyond, it's been, ooh,
ooh,
this problematic. What are these white people
yes.
describing the poor black culture? If you can remove just the political baggage that attends to that at different moments in history, did they get something wrong?
Well, let's just say, to remove the political baggage, I think the thing is, it actually can't be removed from political baggage because we're in America and you just can't take out, you know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, we, you
yes.
know, so, but let's just say, if I were Susan Lloyd Parks, me, and living in New York City in 1936, wanting to write about maybe Jewish folks on the Lower East Side.
That would have been interesting.
Well, exactly. And I would have written maybe an opera or a play or a poem even. It would have been from my point of view. Now, I'm an outsider to that community. I mean, here I am, an African-American woman, an outsider to that community, an African-American woman, and here we are. And do I have access like someone who is of the more of the community? So there is a somewhat of a distance that happens. And when there's a distance that happens, there's things that are missed. There are things that are misunderstood. It's not a crime. I think
It's not racist.
Exactly, to my mind. Now, there are scholars and folks and people, black, white, and other, and the multitude of people who might say it's racist. For me, personally, I had to work on it. And for me, calling something racist, you know, that's a room that...
It's a certain... There are things that are racist, but it seems as many epithets like that are too easily defaulted to as
well,
an explanation for everything.
Well, there are things in the world.
In the world.
Yes, there are things in the world that are racist. And I think that for me, entering into the room of the Gershwin's Porgy and Bess, I saw it differently. I think that what's unfortunate about a lot of people, they hear Susan Lloyd Parks is working on it, or they hear a black woman is working on it.
They're
trying
to whitewash it, shall we say.
Yeah, or she must be finding, she'll find racist, and then she'll have to fix, you know, all these political.
Right.
And me, I'm sitting here as a Pulitzer Prize winning, MacArthur Genius Grant winning writer. I look at it as, yes, as a black woman, but also as a writer.
You won the Pulitzer Prize for a very innovative piece of theater. You are an often called an experimental theater person. You've also worked a lot in showbiz. Doing a television movie for Oprah Winfrey, writing screenplays for Brad Pitt, and you're Miss Hollywood as well. did Ray Charles musical that I want to see?
Oh, yeah.
Were you bringing to some way that kind of mass accessible pop sensibility to this piece of work?
What did I bring? I mean, it sounds corny, but I brought love. It's like, that's the thing. They say that love has no color and love has no, it's like you just bring like, wow, I love this music. I love these people. I love what this can be. And you fill it with that. So you're not trying to make it experimental or pop or anything. You're just trying to get the strongest story for these people. So it will really go hand in glove with the beautiful music and just tell the story in the best possible way. When I sit down and work on it, I'm not thinking it has to be for Broadway. I'm not thinking, how many seats are in the Richard Rodgers Theater? Maybe over 1,000. I don't know. The lots of seats. I'm not thinking, I better write this line because if I don't, then we'll lose 500 seats or something. I'm not thinking that at all.
Back in a few years ago, you wrote a play a day, a little play every day for a year.
Yes.
365 of them.
Yes.
They were produced all over the country.
All over the world,
All over the world.
Sorry,
Which always struck me, as soon as I heard about it then, as an amazing stunt if one had agreed to do it, I could see about 3 months in going, what have I done to myself? But I wondered, did it change the way you work? I mean, just doing that for a year, has it changed your work subsequently?
That was the thing. That was the thing that I wrote after Top Dog Underdog, and people were expecting me, write the next Broadway thing, and we were everywhere but Broadway. We were in Myanmar, and it was just a process of waking up every day and going, what do I see, and what do I want to show? So it made the process of writing very modest, I guess you could say. So I'm more modest in my... I can't explain it.
All I have to do is what I have to do today, I guess.
Yeah. And just be generous and kind and loving and share. That's all.
In addition to being generous and loving and kind, you've started performing more.
Yes.
And you perform as Sula Parks.
Yeah. Oh, where are you? You know everything about me now.
Pretty much. And there's more to come. Who is that? Let me meet her.
She has a guitar, and I sing and play. And I just thought it would be fun to have another personality.
Sing me a bar or two.
I'll sing you. This is from Bronze Star, and it's I wrote it for my dad, who was a Vietnam veteran.
And a lieutenant colonel.
And came home with a Bronze Star. So the guitar part is really cool, but you just have to imagine that I'm playing a cool guitar part. So it goes, my daddy, he came home with a big Bronze Star, and he bought himself this two-seater car. It was a triumph. For all he won for us, he said, it was a miracle. Mama said he didn't come back. Flag draped and dead. So it goes on from there.
Susan Laurie Parks, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was fun being here.
The Gershwin's Porgy and Bess is on Broadway now. Have you seen it? If so, tell us what you think at studio360.org. And while you're at our website, we have lots more great stories for you to read and listen to, including one about the new National Pinball Museum, which just opened in Baltimore. Check it out at studio360.org. The Tom Hanks Sandra Bullock movie, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, just came out. It is an adaptation of the 9/11 novel by Jonathan Safran Foer.
The search for the sixth borough was the greatest expedition ever.
All right, I've got amateur entomologists, francophile, amateur archaeologists, computer consultants.
Why amateur everything?
It's a compliment.
Amateur pacifist?
When I talked to Foer about the book a few years ago, he told me how the collage boxes made by the artist Joseph Cornell had inspired him to rethink the craft of fiction.
I was a freshman in college, and I was taking a sculpture course, as in making, not studying. But at the beginning of each class, we had a 10-minute slideshow. And over the course of the semester, we got this quick and dirty tour of sculpture, the history of sculpture. And I went up to the teacher after class, and I said, "Who was that artist with the boxes? What was his name?" He said, "Joseph Cornell." I went to the art library, looked at a book of his images. I tried to find other books. I tried to see the boxes in any museums that I could. For whatever reason, I don't know why, it struck me. Most of all, I wanted to make something that was like them. And in the beginning, I just imitated them. I actually made a whole bunch of Cornell box replicas. You know, I would take Da Vinci images. I would go to the National Gallery, where they have a wonderful Da Vinci painting, and they sell little posters and postcards. So right then, you have two sizes of the same image, and I would cut them out and apply those to... I remember one I made in particular, these little teacups my parents got when they on a trip to Japan. And I applied these images to these teacups, and I put them in a box that was supposed to be a photo album that I got on Hanukkah years ago and never used. And, you know, one thing leads to another, and then you have your own little replica, which is good for absolutely nothing. With Cornell, I felt like this was made for me. The effect that those boxes had on me was something I wanted to perpetuate, and I realized I could do it better not by imitating what he did, but by trying to find my own language. Cornell's work was very beautiful because it really inspired me. Beautiful things want to be replicated. That's what beautiful things are. That you see a beautiful person, you want to draw that person. Someone sees your drawing, they want to make a painting. Someone sees that painting, they want to take a picture of that painting. Someone sees your picture, they want to go for a walk in nature. So, you know, and it's this endless chain of people being excited by this beautiful thing that came before them. When I'm writing, I feel like 90% of what I'm doing is trying to stop making sense and create something that just has an effect, just is experiential. You know, my dream is for people to read my books like on desert islands or at heightened moments in heightened places. Feeling that way about art, it's like a muscle. And once you know how to use it, you can use it more and it gets stronger. I didn't know what it was like really to love a work of art until Joseph Cornell came along.
The novelist Jonathan Safran Foer talking about the artist Joseph Cornell. The movie, based on his novel, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, is out now. Has some work of art ever changed your life? If so, we'd like to hear about it at studio360.org. Coming up next on the show, Tom Waits talks about one of the strangest albums ever. Way stranger than any of his own.
It's so unlike anything that we all consider music to be. And to dance to this, there aren't really any existing dances appropriate.
Curious? Well, then stay with us. This is Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
Every so often, Studio 360 finds some ubiquitous design glitch or cherished cultural object that's gone a little moldy that we then remake. We recently heard from some teachers who hate the old-fashioned iconography. ABCs, 1-2-3s, blackboards, apples. Apple crapple, they call it. So we found a design team to take the case and rebrand educators for the 21st century. It's a New York firm called HyperAct that's done projects for UNICEF and Good Magazine, among others.
Maybe we can think of teachers and students as organisms.
Little ecosystem.
Little dots coming to one little and then some
molecular structures.
HyperAct brought in a former public school teacher named Jenna Shapiro to help them brainstorm.
The visual language associated with the word teacher is so sort of limited and dated. There is no little red schoolhouse. There is no, you know, the concept of classroom is changing. What we know about the way kids learn and where kids learn is changing.
Why is it that the word teacher doesn't have that reverence that other professions have? And that's sort of our biggest challenge, to elevate the profession to its rightful place of importance in our society.
That's DeRoy Peraza. He co-founded HyperAct with Julia Vaxer-Zeltzer.
The initial concept that DeRoy threw at us when we started discussions this morning was the street finding, wayfinding signage.
Right. Hospitals are marked in our geography with signage. The letter H is immediately associated with hospital. It gets a whole letter in our alphabet that's instantly recognizable as this important place. Mm-hmm. Why can't education have a letter that recognizes its importance? It needs to be a landmark. It needs to have the same level of importance in our society as our health.
Doctors have MD in the end of their name. Maybe we could get Jenna Shapiro, E, in the end. Educator. Something like that.
That'd be pretty cool.
Yeah. We're trying to appeal to teachers instead of children. And previously, the apple, the pencil, the chalkboard, all that was for children, not for those who are teaching.
Right. It's really hard to create a symbol that just comes automatically with this pile of meaning and everybody just gets it.
It has to be simple icon that is equivalent to a peace sign or recycle logo.
Maybe we should look at the infinity symbol.
Yeah.
It's been with us since the beginning of human history, and it will continue to be with us forever.
Sort of like educational.
Right.
Next week, the folks from HyperAct will show me their new look for educators. But in the meantime, I can safely say, teachers, no more apple crapple. A few months ago, I saw a funny tweet from John Huntsman. You know, the Republican presidential candidate. It read, "I wonder if a tweet where I admit how much I like Captain Beefheart will make the followers skyrocket even more." Well, no, but Huntsman is not alone in his enthusiasm. Last year, the Library of Congress inducted a Captain Beefheart record into its National Recording Registry. It's called Trout Mask Replica. Released in 1969, it's part free jazz, part blues, part beat poetry. Frank Zappa, no surprise, produced the record, and he's the one who gave Don Van Vliet, the singer and songwriter, the name Captain Beefheart. To tell the whole story of Trout Mask Replica, we have the album's musical director.
My name is John French, and I was the drummer in the Magic Band and also the transcriber of probably 70-80% of the music, which I also taught to the other players.
Don Van Vliet's biographer.
My name's Mike Barnes. I'm the author of the book Captain Beefheart.
And one of the album's biggest fans.
Tom Waits, musician. Prepare yourself for a glimpse into the future. These are like recipes for curatives, ancient oils.
The black paper between a mirror breaks my heart. Moon frayed through dark velvet lightly apart. Steal softly through sunshine. Steal softly through snow.
When people hear Captain Beefheart's music for the first time, it can be quite a daunting prospect because what you had was quite a harsh and quite a distant sound. that you'd probably only heard in free jazz albums before. It was the first time, really, that you'd heard that kind of structure in rock music.
It's so unlike anything that we all consider music to be. And to dance to this, there aren't really any existing dances appropriate.
Steal softly through sunshine, steal softly through snow.
I met Don Van Vliet and the Magic Band, all the members, the same night, and I was asked to join in around October of 1966. I was in a different generation than these guys. These guys came out of the 50s, you know, with rock and roll and doo-wop music, hot rods and pachuco clothes and haircuts. You know, they were sort of the badass kind of guys.
Well, you can hear his influences, which is interesting. Always, Howlin' Wolf is very present.
But by the time Captain Beefheart got to Trautmark's Replica, which was recorded in 1969, he decided to employ a different compositional process.
My smile is stuck, I cannot go back to your frown land.
It starts out with Frownland, which is this total chaos.
It sounds like it's been made up on the spot, but in fact it was rigorously learnt, so the players would play the tracks the same way every time.
With musicians, a lot of the time, what they really need to do is unlearn it. For myself, the first time I heard Trautmask, I had to stop and pause and look at what it was that I was doing that I thought was interesting, relevant, or worthwhile. I just had never encountered anything filled with so much abandon.
Now here she come walking, looking like a zoo. Hiella, hiella guru.
It was hard to believe that it was actually conducted and designed.
I think John French deserves a lot of credit for his role in the realization of Trautmark's Replica, because without his diligent work on it, transcribing piano lines or trying to make sense of a number of tapes that Don Van Vliet had made of whistling, scat singing. I think if he hadn't been able to do that, it just could easily not have worked at all.
You're talking about people playing in different keys, different time signatures, all at the same time, and you had to figure out how to end and start each section together.
And then fly apart again. Like one of those moments in a large gathering where everyone's talking at the same time and then all of a sudden, there's a moment of silence, and you don't know. It couldn't have been predicted.
Fast and bulbous.
And then the talking starts again.
Fast and bulbous.
That's right, the mascara snake. Fast and bulbous.
Bulbous also tapered.
Yeah, but you've got to wait until I say. Also, a tin teardrop.
Oh, Christ.
The circumstances under which Trautmark's Replica was rehearsed were certainly not conditions I would like to have been in myself. They were in grinding poverty and they had a very harsh work regime. Beefheart would, for instance, deprive people of sleep. He would keep them up all night.
He would have these talks. He'd call it, oh, John's got a thing, like a hang-up or a problem, and we've got to talk about this. So we'd sit down, and the talks would sometimes erupt into violence. So it became a very uncomfortable and paranoid situation.
Captain Beefheart himself said about Trautmark's Replica, let it come to you, play it whilst you're washing up the dishes or doing the housework. There is a logic to it. It's just trying to get used to a sort of different musical language.
The one thing that I think Don was able to bring into the whole equation, and I don't mean this in a negative way, but he didn't know what he was doing. Captain Beefheart realized the possibilities that existed in music if you looked past the rules.
Like a bee trapped in an outhouse while a man changes a tire and a plane passes over and Jay is yammering and a skateboard comes by and hits all the cracks right on time.
Tom Waits, Mike Barnes, and John French talking about Captain Beefheart's 1969 album, Trout Mask Replica. Don Van Vliet, also known as Captain Beefheart, died in 2010. Our series on the National Recording Registry is produced by Ben Manila, Devin Strolovich, and Eric Byth. It receives support from the Library of Congress. And that's it for this week's show. Thanks very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen next time. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Alana Harper,
Katie Long,
Sharon Mashihi.
Thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you? And by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, what's it like for David Byrne to watch 35-year-old Talking Heads videos?
This is a person who is profoundly uncomfortable addressing an audience and yet puts himself in that position. If I can refer to my earlier self in the third person, he had to.
David Byrne, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.